It's great to be here. It's always difficult to live up to those kind of introductions, but I do feel, in the context of people interested in heart-mind learning, interested in what the Dalai Lama Center is trying to achieve, that the work of those of us who work in the early years of children's development, we do really have some pretty important messages, I think, that belong in this field. And I think some of the work that is being done in collaboration now between the Dalai Lama Center and the Human Early Learning Partnership is work that you should be aware of, because I think it could have a potential to make the agenda of the Dalai Lama Center really land and stick in this province and perhaps other places. So what I've been asked to do is spend about 20 minutes talking about these things, and then Maria will come up and we'll have a conversation together afterwards. Well, where I want to start, though, is with what to me is like an Ur slide. What this is, it's a slide showing sensitive periods in early brain development. And so you can see along the bottom there is the ages 0 through to school age and then into the primary grades with a kind of a gray to white transition in the preschool to the school years. And then each of those lines that's going up and coming down then is about a competence that is developing in the brain. And so during that period of it going up is when all sorts of brain cell to brain cell connections are potentially being created around that given competence. And as it's coming down, the irrelevant connections are being sculpted away. So what's going on during this period of time, early in life, is that we have the densest number of these sensitive periods in brain development that you will ever have. And the things that the brain is trying to do are very, very foundational at that point. And what I want to do then is tell you three stories about what's going on early on, because these three stories really frame the reason that I think that if we're going to take social and emotional learning, heart-mind education seriously, we have to start at the beginning. So you see the white line there, which represents vision, and it shows that right from the time of birth onward, there is a sensitive period going on in the visual pathways. There's a lot of different things that are going on there, but the most important thing for us is that the visual pathways are starting to connect to deep structures in the brain where a sense of affiliation and attachment is found. So for those of you who are interested in the science, you can think about the amygdala and the locus coeruleus and things like that. The point is, those connections are being created according to the experience that the children are having. So at birth, a child's focal length is about 13 inches. In other words, sort of breast to face length, right? And for those children who are getting a consistent set of human faces at the focal length, they start to imprint the human face as the self. And the circuits between the visual pathways and the deep affiliative structures start to decode the meaning of the smile and the frown and so forth. So that the notions of where I stand in relation to others and that others are me and all the rest of it gets biologically embedded early on in life, long before anybody can make conscious decisions about that. So for those of us who know what happens with children who are neglected, they quite often seem very precocious, because even by a year and a half of age, they will not react when adults come in and out of the room one way or another. And people think, isn't that nice? Aren't they easy to take care of? Well, it isn't nice. What that's about is not attending to the human face, not learning to socialize from the human face, not learning to understand what the facial expressions that others are displaying means about where you stand in relation to them. And those kids who have that then, when they get older and start to do all sorts of voluntary things, those are, you know, the 12-year-old girl who will set up her own porn site, et cetera, et cetera. And I speak about that example because I'm thinking about a specific example that is like that, right? So that is going on early on. And the fact is, hard thing to say, fact is, you miss that during the first year and a half, you don't get it back, actually. You don't get that one back. Second story. You notice as we're going up here, there's curves for emotional control, habitual ways of responding, peer social skills. What this goes at is some of the most important things about physical and relational aggression. And I'll tell you the physical aggression story. Most Canadians, be they people with children or people who work with children or not, believe that children are at their most physically aggressive when they are teenagers, and that they got that way by learning it off of television and things like that. That's what people think. So the model is tabula rasa, we're all born good, and then we learn this stuff from TV, and then it happens there. That, from a developmental perspective, is entirely wrong. If you do what has been done, and done best in Canada by Richard Tremblay and his team in McGill, which is to watch children from behind a one-way glass mirror as they grow up and score their interactions objectively, not based on how strong they are, but what they do, what you see is that in the second year of life, when kids are mobile enough to start getting at each other, that physical aggression is one of the very common and popular early attempts at social negotiation. So you put two kids in a room and one toy, and it will not take very long before you get criminal code violations. Right? Now, people always laugh when I say that. But in retrospect, I urge you, and I wish I had one of these things to show you, actually to watch a YouTube video of what this looks like, right? So small kid picks up toy. Larger kid comes along, takes the toy away from the smaller kid, and bangs them over the head with it, and knocks them to the ground, right? That sort of thing goes on every 30 seconds or so, right? And in fact, what happens is, by 24 to 40 months of age, the highest fraction of kids who are ever going to be physically aggressive have declared themselves by then. And it's not that the environment caused them, not that they got it off of television. It is, in effect, virtually a random or a temperamental-driven attempt at social negotiation. Where the environment comes in is the unlearning. Right? So when you have kids who are physically aggressive and are not easily learning to replace physical aggression with verbal negotiation skills, and they are growing up in environments where they're not being encouraged out of that, and they reach school age still like that, those are the kids who are at highest risk of still being physically aggressive by teenage and creating the coercive environments that bring others in. And it's only when they get strong enough to do real damage that we wake up and get upset and carry on. Now, this knowledge that I'm talking about has been out there and has been a subject of consensus in developmental psychology for 20 years. And I'm actually getting angry about this, to be honest with you. You know, because, you know, kid commits suicide after being bullied, and everybody gets out there and talks about the zero tolerance for bullying and stuff. If we mean zero tolerance for bullying, we mean we pay attention to development, and we understand what we already know, and we act on what we already know. We don't simply wait around for kids to get strong enough to do real damage or get insidious enough in their relational aggression to hound somebody to death, and then put on, in effect, theatrics about what we're going to do. So that's the second story. The third story is that in these early years, what's starting to happen is that those affiliative structures that I've been talking about before, the deep structures that tell you whether or not you belong or whether you're under threat, they are starting to communicate with the prefrontal cortex, the executive function centers, where consciousness is formed and where you pay attention to different things. Now, that takes a long time to develop, and the prefrontal cortex is still developing well into the third decade of life. But by the time kids reach school age, already what's happened is that there are very, very sharp differences between kids who have grown up in environments which are calm, secure, and supportive versus kids that have grown up in environments that are physically or emotionally threatening. And if you take the physically threatening side, what happens is, by school age, you can show, and it's been shown in the laboratory, that children who come out of those environments are, in a sense, mobilized and hunkered down. And they are watching. And they see in adult faces threat. where the rest of us don't see it. So you can imagine, for instance, you bring kids into the laboratory, you put a helmet on their head with 132 leads, and you show them an adult face that's very happy, and then the same adult face that's a little less happy, a little less happy, and a little more angry, a little more angry. You go through 10 faces, and you watch to see when the kids have a fear response. Well, for those kids who have grown up in supportive environments, they don't show fear until about the seventh face out of 10. For the kids who've grown up in environments where there's been physical aggression and anger, they show it after about the fourth face. So imagine two kids come into school, beginning at kindergarten. There's the teacher standing there looking at them quizzically. One kid looks at the teacher and thinks, there is a teacher looking at me quizzically. There's another kid thinking, that person's about to hit me, right? And that is already in the circuitry. It's embedded in the circuitry by school age, right? So if what we're going to say is that social and emotional learning is going to start at school age, what exactly are we saying? So this notion of biologically embedding, I've used the term several times now because we do now understand that, in fact, what happens is that processes, you know, land at the level of the whole child, but they penetrate down and they affect both the structure and the function of the developing brain, and they do so right down to the level of the gene, right? So we understand that, in fact, early experience, be it positive nurturant, be it threatening, be it indifferent, turns on and off different brain structures in different ways. And just to give you a little kind of cartoon of it, there is a piece of DNA there, which would be a gene. So that's what you call a coding sequence, right? So that's a bunch of DNA there that does potentially metabolic work. And so what happens is it gets transcribed onto something called messenger RNA. Doesn't matter too much what that is. And that creates proteins, and proteins do the work, okay? So that's a building block of the DNA, and we have about 24,000 of those in our DNA. We also have little stretches of DNA at the front that says start. This is where the good stuff starts, and this is where it stops, right? So it tells the RNA where to start reading, right? Because it has to transcribe and then translate. And then it turns out, in front of that stuff, there's something called a promoter. And a promoter is like a dimmer switch. And so what it does is it has the capacity to increase or decrease the rate at which that gene is transcribed, right? So there's this thing called RNA polymerase, and you can imagine if the dimmer switch is turned up, it's going like the old Visa things, right? But if it's turned down, it's going right, and then we're filing for bankruptcy. The key thing that we now understand, and this is the revolution of the last 10 years, is that social experience, as represented by those figures there, can actually, through the agency of a thing called methylation, can modulate the dimmer switch. So what's going on is the environment is talking to the genome through these chemical cascades, and the genome is listening and behaving differently. And sometimes, when it starts to behave differently, the changes are permanent and carry on across the balance of the life course. So when we talk about the idea of early experience becoming biologically embedding, we're not talking about it metaphorically. We're saying that the neglect of that child in the first 18 months of life is embedded in the way in which brain circuitry is created, and it's very hard to root it out once that's happened, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's what we're saying, which means that social and emotional learning literally does begin at the beginning. Now, having said that, because of the importance of these things, we have, over the last 10 years in BC, been embarking on a program of looking at the state of children's development when they reach transition into school age. You might say to me, well, hold on, if you said that, you know, it's things that go on much earlier than that are really important, why do you wait until transition to school age? And the answer is because we can find all the kids and we can afford to do the assessments and we have a valid tool to do it with. That raises another question. But anyway, what happens is in BC, and it's happened four times through now and we're on our fifth wave, is we get the kindergarten teachers, after they've known their children for about 5 months, to fill out these things called the early development instrument on the kid. And there's 104 items on these things. It's like a checklist. And it has information on their physical health and well-being, on their social competence in terms of how they function in the semi-formal environment of the kindergarten class, on their emotional maturity in terms of how they treat each other as peers. Are they helpful and empathic? Are they physically aggressive? Are they relationally aggressive? It has information on it about, you know, basic readiness for school in terms of their language and cognitive development, and also in terms of their capacity to understand and make themselves understood in the school. And by getting all of the kindergarten teachers in a geographic schools district bought out of a day of their time, we can get these things filled out on all the kids, and we can produce population-based information that shows what the state of development of children is across an entire residential neighborhood or entire geographic school district or a, you know, a city like Vancouver or something like that. And so what we end up producing is maps like this. So this is a map based on one of our waves of EDI data from BC, showing the southwest corner of the province where about 3/4 of the people live, divided into neighborhoods in the city and into hamlets in the smaller areas, right? And it shows the fraction of kids who are what we call vulnerable, by which we mean they're behind where we'd like them to be in their development on one or more of those five scales of the EDI. The physical, social, emotional, language, and cognitive or communication skills scale. And what you can see when you look across this is that there are green neighborhoods based on the kids' six-digit postal code. We put them into where they live, where between 4 and 20% of the kids are vulnerable in their development. And then it goes up to the light green, the yellow, the light pink, and then the dark reddish kind of color, where it goes up over 60%, as you can see. So across here in wealthy British Columbia, one of the top 10 successful countries in the world, we currently have more than tenfold difference in the fraction of kids who are starting school vulnerable in one or more domains of their development. Now, overall, on average in BC, about 30% of the kids are going to school vulnerable in their development. At the time of birth, about 4% are born with something biological which might lead them to be vulnerable. So between birth and the time that kids reach school age, that number seems to have increased sevenfold. And neighborhood differences in vulnerability rates at birth, which might be 2 or 3-fold, have now turned into something that are 10 and 15-fold large. So this is about the different opportunities that kids are having to have access to quality nurturant experience in the early years. Now, this is general, right, that we're talking about here. We're putting all of the scales together. But because of the work of the Dalai Lama Center, when we started to work back and forth, we said, you know, we have 104 items in here. And some of the items that are in the EDI go directly at the kind of things that the Dalai Lama Center cares about, the kind of early elements that are the early determinants of the capacity to do social and emotional learning, as I've described before. And so what we've done then over the last while is to dig into this tool further down and start looking at ways that we can use it to shine a light on heart-mind well-being across the whole population so that we can really carry on a principled public dialogue about the state of our children in terms of the domains of development that we want for them in heart-mind learning, and to set a baseline, in a sense, for us to be able to make a difference over time. You know, as I mentioned, this is a partnership between the Dalai Lama Center that has the objectives and the vision, and the Human Early Learning Partnership, which has the data resources. And so what we did is we've, over the last couple of years, we embarked on a process whereby we went through the 104 items on the EDI, and we pulled out about 55 or 60 of them that could conceivably, by anybody's imagination, have something to do with social and emotional learning and heart-mind development. And then we handed those items over to a number of people who have been involved intimately in the Dalai Lama Center. And we asked them to score them 1, 2, and 3. You know, so a 1 would be, yeah, this is exactly the kind of thing we're thinking about. A 2 would be, yeah, we're probably, yeah, that's important too. And a 3 would be, you know, it's probably not that important. And this was an interesting piece of learning because it required people to actually engage in a irritating, humdrum, but important exercise of trying to say, what specifically do we mean by heart-mind education? What do we mean by social and emotional learning in that sense? And so after a bit of struggle, We came up with a group of about 30-some-odd items that we then started working with and rearranging into various scales. And then along came the developmental psychologist and said, but you know, you've missed some things. So we want to go back. We want to look at some of those items that you threw out, and we want to get at some of the things that underlie these things, some of the things that are about emotional self-regulation that people wouldn't think of intuitively. And so in the end, we came up with a tool that was a bit of a consensus between these different groups. So what is it? It's the Heart-Mind Index, and it basically has five elements together, making up about 37 out of the 104 items on the EDI. So it has items about whether or not the kids are attentive and engaged, whether they're secure and calm, whether they're peaceful, whether they're compassionate and kind, and whether or not they get along with others. And so, for instance, you know, the getting along with others deals with what the kindergarten teachers have said about their cooperativeness and their resistance for inappropriate social pressure, et cetera, et cetera. They're preventing, managing, and resolving interpersonal conflict. So you understand that what the teachers answer is not a complex thing like this, that we ask, you know, does the child do this, does the child do that? And these are the underlying dimensions behind it. The compassionate and kind is about early evidence of empathy and compassion and even altruism, one way or another. Peacefulness, do they avoid conflict? Do they try to resolve conflicts, et cetera? Secure and calm, you know, how much inner resilience do they seem to have? Do they manage stress and worries? Do they prevent anxiety? Do they foster resiliency one way or another? And attentive and engaged, you know, this has got to do with self-regulation, impulse control, that sort of thing, ability to change perspective, et cetera. So you can see what we're doing here. Right? Digging down into this database that the kindergarten teachers have provided us over time and starting to come up with elements that we would like to see be part of the public discussion about the development of the heart and the mind. And then what we're going to ultimately do is go back and engage in mapping and put this back in neighborhoods and ask where are the differences coming from. Now, the reason that I haven't done that here, we haven't done that here, is because we're still in development. We're doing, the team is doing appreciative inquiries around this and learning people's reaction. But just to give you some hypothetical ideas, these show hypothetical neighborhoods showing the fraction of kids who would come out with high scores, medium scores, and low scores on these different scales. And as you can see, like I showed you before, there's variations between these five neighborhoods that are not really hypothetical, but they're anonymized in the greater Vancouver area. And so then that becomes the basis for discussion and for thinking about what we're going to do. And so what we want to be able to do then is to use this in a sense in a bi-directional way. We want to say, we take a look backwards in time and say, if we have areas that consistently over time are low on various domains of the Heart-Mind Index, what can we do to support the early years in those areas that can transform that? And on the other hand, we want to look forward in times and say, you know, if you look at neighborhoods or if you rearrange the data into schools and we find areas that are challenged on various domains, what do we do to make a difference before we end up with the situations where kids are committing suicide because of bullying? And with that, I'm going to stop talking. And I guess we'll have our conversation, Maria.